Welcome back, everyone. I hope you have had quite the party in your household over lunch and you are ready and settled in for a cracking afternoon. Disasters amplify the existing fault lines already experienced by people with disability to live an ordinary life. The best way to truly understand the impact of disasters on people with disability is to hear their stories firsthand, as we saw in the last presentation. This session is a case study video showcasing the real-life stories and impact on three people with disabilities in the midst of 2020 disasters. Please listen to the stories of Tim, James, and Mark.
For those living with disability, 2020 has offered many challenges, particularly for those living with disability. Bushfires and the pandemic have made life difficult for these Victorians. Here are three of their stories.
My name's Mark Oakley and we're at Dirty Hollow Creek, Wisely, 20 kilometres east of Bairnsdale.
Ever since we've moved out to this block, we've been aware that bushfires and are going to be there for us, and that every year we prepare for it. And this year it was different. First, a big plume, then all the birds out of the bush started hanging around the back door and squawking and making a noise. We just felt and knew it was time to go. So we packed up our stuff, and a few hours later, everything was gone. It just blew through there from the south and melted everything to the ground, apart from our solar system and batteries, which survived.
30 years ago or so, I got Balm Forest virus, Ross River virus, which gave me fibromyalgia, and had a bit of spinal damage on my neck, upper neck, and some sort of growth in my spine at the bottom, emphysema, and just had a heart attack a couple of years ago.
Mark's challenges are that the access into the caravan is quite difficult, and showering in the caravan and going to the toilet and things like that is quite difficult. When the bushfires first happened and we come back and decided that we wanted to live on the block, we did ask if there were any services out there that could provide us with a portable shower toilet unit. We're into the eighth month now and still no sign of a shower or toilet block.
We've been very fortunate that we've been donated a shed by the Red Gum Church in Bairnsdale. Because of all this red tape and all the hoops you've got to jump through and all the paperwork you've got to do, help from the disability services, we haven't had any. I cannot see why the government organisations couldn't have actually helped us more with Mark's situation.
Psychologically, getting back to my place was a big thing. I just wanted to be back there and give me peace of mind one way or another. And then after that, the amount of paperwork and phone calls and meetings and things becomes confusing as to what you're supposed to actually be doing, and the actual personal need seems to be overrun with furniture and clothes and things. I need a toilet that I can sit down on properly, and a shower that if I fall over I won't break through the glass, or that Jane can wash me and help me. Not getting those facilities makes it rather difficult and a bit more dangerous for me, so I don't shower as much.
COVID has made it a lot more difficult. When the pandemic started, we were living at the caravan park with my mum in her little unit down there, and we weren't quite ready to leave there and go back to the caravan. We hadn't set up a few little things that would make life easy. And then the pandemic started, and then the owners of the caravan park said that we would no longer be able to stay at the caravan park because we weren't a permanent resident, so we had to move into the caravan, and we just had to cope the best way we could. Mark wants to see his last days there eventually, and that's his wish, so that's why we would like to rebuild again.
We're connected to it, and I just can't let it go. We can't let it go.
Tim Chan has been in lockdown with his mother Sarah in Melbourne.
My brand of autism means that I am dealing with a body that is not always in sync with my intentions, so it is very challenging to go through daily life. The pandemic has brought unprecedented changes to routines, on which I rely heavily to manage my constant anxiety, which has skyrocketed. I so life is difficult because I miss the connection with people. I suppose this is true for each person, with or without disability. However, because I use non-conventional communication, assisted typing, it's not easy to connect as it takes trained facilitators with whom I have a personal relationship before I can output typing. So I am feeling especially alone and vulnerable.
My name is Sarah Chan. I have a son, Tim, who has severe autism. And we've been in lockdown, which is having an impact on us. And support workers are not really able to maintain their presence in Tim's life. So it's been quite hard for all of us.
My support workers are my friends as well, because they facilitate my type-to-talk communication. It has been lonely. My mum, who I live with, has to take on all the care and supervision of my daily routines and activities. Because she has been without any respite or support, this is taking a heavy toll. Both lack of sleep and anxiety have been the cause of more seizures. I am also afraid of hurting mum or myself when I have fits, in case I fall onto her, or when she has to physically keep me from falling.
Tim's 25 at the moment. He was diagnosed with autism at the age of 3. He is a non-speaker. He never really achieved speech despite a lot of early intervention. He's very dependent on me, as you can see, especially in the present condition. He needs that one-to-one supervision and attention, support at all times. So I'm sort of pretty much a full-time parent, very full-time parent.
Diversity. I think people can be educated to be more aware of differences and neurodiversity. Government has been very ableist in their thinking. They should include disability voices, find alternatives to incorporate our perspective and listen to us from different viewpoints.
During lockdown, it's very hard to connect with people in face-to-face situations, but hopefully when the pandemic ends, community groups and organizations can provide opportunities for people with disability to come together. And I think it's very important to talk about your experiences with other people who have experienced pretty much similar things. We've become very resilient. COVID-19 is something that we need to go through, of course. But I think with all the experiences of the past, it's built us up, to do that.
James Griffiths has found life in 2020 increasingly isolating.
My name is James Griffiths. I live in Sale, Gippsland, Victoria. Volunteering is my everything. It gives me something to strive for, and it gives me happiness. It's food for my soul. The bushfires and this pandemic has made me feel pretty useless. I'm trapped in a black box. Staying at home now, I'm stuck in four walls in a black box. Can't get out, can't do the things that I'd want to do. Today for this interview, this is the first time I've been out of the house in a couple of weeks. A little known fact about myself is I'm a double transplant recipient. Now, being immunosuppressed, I've got to be very careful on where I go, what I do, how I touch things. During this pandemic, I've noticed there's been a reduction in services. Where I used to be able to walk into my local council and find out information, most times now, it's all over the phone or it's all via Zoom. All this new technology I've got to learn. It's not impossible, but it's really, really hard considering being blind and not knowing much about technology in the first place. And then having to try and learn the new technology to gain the services that you need. So I'm feeling right now that having a disability, I'm left right out of the loop. Facebook, for example, you know, there might be a picture that's been put into a post, then on my screen reader, I can't read that because it just says picture may contain text. Not all those things are completely accessible. And it almost seems like it's a hassle for a lot of organisations to do it, and they get frustrated, but you know, it shouldn't be an afterthought. It should be, you know, the first thing that they think of. How can we make this information accessible to everybody? Every day I hear there's been 300 new cases in Victoria. No, there's been 12 more deaths. No, there's every day. And it makes me wonder, if I go out, am I going to be the next one of these 300 new people with COVID? Everybody's asking, no, we want to hear from you, we want to hear from you. My message to change makers is, get your head out of the sand. There's a lot more that's happening out there. You just need to look for it. Don't forget us.
Powerful, wasn't it? So let's go to a panel of experts to discuss. Remember to put your questions for the panel in via the Q&A box. Who best to lead a discussion than the amazing Bridget Tehan, Policy Officer of Emergency Management from VCOS, who will guide our panel of experts through a discussion about all we've heard today. Welcome, Bridget.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for that lovely introduction. It's made me smile and it's made my day. I just wanted to really firstly start off by acknowledging you, Melissa, and the amazing work that you've done and all of the team in pulling this together. It's just been so incredible so far, what we've heard. And I really wanted to, acknowledge the work of Michelle and Angela with those really practical projects on working with people with a disability around person-centred emergency planning and preparedness. So actually encouraging people to own their own plans, being best placed, of course, to do that planning. And secondly, Angela's project, which she discussed in the second session or in the third session of this morning, and looking at the Country Fire Authority, or the CFA as it was then, and that amazing project that Angela's undertaken, looking at supporting bushfire planning for people with additional needs and working with local community organisations to undertake that work as well. So, you know, really extraordinary work going on right across Australia. And look, I don't have doubt that there are many other projects underway as well. I'm really pleased to be here today and to be supporting this forum. And enough about me, I don't want to talk too much. I do want to say, though, well done to Tony for appearing live today. We could just see that was a really, really tough thing for her to do. And I want to pass on a huge congratulations from not only me, but from the many, many people that commented as you appeared live, Tony. You did just such an amazing job. And the messages that you imparted were really profound and really meaningful and will hopefully make a difference for other people with a disability. So what I'm going to do today is not do too much talking. We have a fantastic lineup of panelists here, and I know that we're all keen to hear from them. So who we have with us today is Christina Ryan, CEO of the Disability Leadership Institute. We have Adrian Terranova, Executive Officer of Gippsland Disability Advocacy. Michelle Watson, who's a coordinator for community programs, aged and disability services, and is the Deputable Municipal Recovery Manager at Yarra City Council. And again, we have Angela Cook, Project Manager at the CFA. I just want to start out by saying that emergency management is really complex. An emergency event might need the help of police, firefighters, ambulance, rescue or life-saving services. If it's a bigger event, it might involve a local council and other organisations. And a really big event, like COVID-19, might include the whole of the state government. And the frameworks under which emergency management arrangements operate are also complex, and they do tend to focus on those emergency services and governments, as I mentioned above. There is a move to community-led emergency management, where communities and community members are involved in all aspects of emergency management, from planning and preparedness through response and relief, and right through to the longer-term recovery process. But we know that people with disabilities are isolated from the mainstream community on a day-to-day basis and face significant barriers in participating in everyday life. So how can we make sure at the outset that they're an integral part of this new community-led approach? Each of our panellists is going to share some of their experiences and reflections of emergencies and propose some real ways forward on a whole lot of different levels that can kind of feed into this complex emergency management arrangement. I'm going to start off by introducing Adrian Terranova, who's the Executive Officer for the Gippsland Disability Advocacy. Adrian, you can, if you would like to tell us a bit about your experiences and your organisation's experiences in both the 2018 as well as the 2019-20 bushfires and some of the challenges that you've faced in undertaking that work, and I guess particularly with regard to funding, which I know has been really troublesome for you. Over to you, Adrian.
Yeah, thank you, Bridget, and good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to just acknowledge that I'm meeting on Gunai Kurnai land and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. It's been a wonderful forum. Thank you, Melissa and the team at Daru for facilitating. My name's Adrian. I work with Gippsland Disability Advocacy. My role's the Executive Officer. I might just quickly, if I may, just talk a little bit about Gippsland Disability Advocacy. We're the regional service for Gippsland, and our mission is to advocate, promote and be responsive to the welfare rights and interests of people with disabilities and to build a more inclusive community. So once we're talking about emergency management, you can see that this is front and centre. I think what happens with emergencies is initially we go into a little bit of self-preservation when there's bushfires and things like this, and instantly we start thinking about ourselves, our family, our friends. And very quickly, we then think about who might be impacted. We then think about our community, where we're working. And instantly, you see and know of a number of people working disability advocacy who would be really, really in a lot of situations where there could be in a lot of problems. So as a result of that, we across East Gippsland on the 29th, 30th and 31st of December, there was a number of community meetings, and we just felt they were in Lakes Entrance, Bensdale, Bruthen, Meetung. We just felt it was really important to have presence and know what was happening at the community meetings so we could at least start engaging with our community for people with disabilities. On the first, from the 1st to the 10th of January, our organisation had presence at the relief centres, which were established across the region. They initially started in Bensdale and then East Gippsland, and that flowed on down to Sale and Morwell. On one day alone, we worked with 19 new clients across those relief centres, and it's fair to say that there was a loss, there was a feeling of isolation, a lot of trauma with regard to that. We just felt it was really important that as a disability advocacy service that the voices of people with disabilities were heard at that point in time. The issues were really wide and varied, from departmental grants to breaking down the barriers to accommodation, as my colleague Denise had mentioned earlier. So lots of different situations. But look, throughout this time, it was high intensity, certainly a lot of engagement through our funding bodies, being the Office for Disability as well as Department of Social Services through the National Disability Advocacy Program. They were very keen to know how we were encountering. What I will say is we certainly had a good opportunity to be able to talk to them, but without the support of Mary Mallett at Disability Advocacy Network Australia and the senior management team at VCOS, we may have struggled somewhat. So they were wonderful in breaking down those barriers for us. We also had really, in saying about the support, Paul Malavasi from the Office for Disability took a very special and keen interest about the work we were doing, and were really supportive of that. Look, difficult time. You're talking about the 29th, 30th, 31st of December up to the 10th of Jan. We had lots of staff on annual leave. we were really blessed that Denise Lamble, my colleagues Denise Lamble and Sam Gamlin, who is our systemic advocate, were willing to come off from annual leave and do some work at the relief centres. I think there's a couple of things here which are really important is I spent a lot of the time at that time advocating, and it sort of took me away from being where I needed to be, was advocating that we got some systems-based scenarios and problems here. And what it's led us to continue to think about is a contingency fund that organisations like ours who can evidence that we're in this space, that governments can start thinking about supporting that, because it literally, it was like they got, everybody got caught short and found out by, oh, a disability advocacy organisation is at the relief centre. It's like it was something out of this world. From our perspective, we found it imperative that we were there, and I would advocate for my colleagues across the state and country that we, the disability advocacy organisations, need to be at relief centres. But it did show up a few flaws in that, you know, from a contingency point of view and funding, how do we make this happen? One thing else I'll just say is being locally and place-based is really important as well. We had a situation where our systemic advocate had really good intel and knowledge of the local Gippsland Grammar School, which obviously had accommodation on site there, which was very accessible. We had a family in East Gippsland who were wheelchair users, who we heard from Denise earlier on, there was no accommodation available, but importantly, need to be accessible. Sam was able to join the dots. So a local place-based organisation was really able to connect in. So, we could talk about it for hours and hours, our work, and we're really passionate about it, but they're just some things that really stuck, you know, just being local, being place-based, knowing our community, being able to build the links with what was available with regards to accommodation, but also the gaps regarding contingency funding and the like. So, yeah.
That's great. Thank you so much, Adrian. And I think you've kind of undersold your story in terms of the role that you did play in supporting people with a disability through those fires. I know for one that you went absolutely above and beyond. I know that your organisation was, you know, scrabbling at the very bottom of its bank account to continue doing the work that you were doing. And a real credit to you to just to be there for not only for your community, but for local people with a disability. And I think it really shows what disability organisations can do and the role that they can play really at the forefront of emergencies, right in that response and relief phase. But they do need recognition, they do need support, and they do need the funding to be able to do this effectively. Thanks so much, Adrian, for sharing, and I'll come back to you a little bit later. Michelle, I'm really keen to hear from you from your perspective from a local council, from a local government, the City of Yarra, and the work that you do and the insights that you've got around working with and for people with disabilities in an emergency management context. Over to you, Michelle.
Thank you, Bridget. Like Adrian and everyone else at this forum, I hope you can hear me okay. I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people.
I think you froze there for a minute.
I think I have. I can hear you, Bridge. I don't know what. Can you hear me? Okay. I've got some other audio happening. Oh, I'm going to.
Just continue on, Michelle. We can hear you loud.
Okay. It's just, all right. I'm going to take this off.
I'm really sorry. I've got some weird delay playback happening.
I think that's you might. Thanks, Michelle. I think you might have the forum actually streaming perhaps through another
time. Okay.
So if you switch that off.
Apologies, everyone.
Great. The joys of technology. We've all done it.
All right. I think it's gone.
That sounds better. Over to you, Michelle.
Oh, phew. Oh, my apologies, everyone. I don't know how, yeah, that's embarrassing. But as I was saying, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people, who are the traditional owners of the land we know as Yarra, and pay my respects to elders, both past, present, and emerging. Thank you, Bridget, for the introduction. It's been, as always, a very busy time for local governments. And I think before I talk about my experiences, I'd just like to acknowledge what a valuable and learning experience this forum has been for me. And I look forward to many more opportunities where we can hear people's voices and stories and experiences so that we can take them on board and learn from them and build that wisdom and knowledge into our practice in emergency management, because I think there are incredible strengths, resiliences, knowledge and passion in the disability space that we can learn about what is working, what's acceptable, and what the gaps are for our communities and where we need to improve. So at Yarra, a lot of the planning, I suppose, there are different stages to emergency management, and I think I'm quite proud of the fact that our planning committee, the Municipal Emergency Management Planning Committee, has representation on that committee with a person with disability, which helps bring insight and understanding to our planning processes, which is just awesome. I would encourage every local government to have that representation at the planning table. I think in response, a lot of our focus and efforts have been around the food safety and food security space. I think we all saw what happened in North Melbourne and Kensington, and how quickly COVID-19 can really impact on everyone in the community, but the extreme impacts it has on people that have difficulty isolating or participating in the community. And I think one of the strengths that we, I suppose, observing what happened on the media and the news, and it's always, you know, take it with a grain of salt, but I think some of the lived stories that we heard about were really, really appalling. And I think we leveraged that understanding and knowledge, well, we need to do better in Yarra as well. And right from the start, we were establishing community forums and meetings a couple of times a week to hear what was needed from the community, what was working, what wasn't working, and what could we do differently. One of the biggest, I think, issues we experienced in listening to community members, and that includes people with disability, was that the 1-800 numbers really didn't work for a lot of people in the community. And a lot of the information out there wasn't working for people with disabilities. So we looked at establishing some supported referral pathways that specialist agencies like those in the disability sector could fast-track people needing support or additional support for us to work with and link into those supports. And that's been a very effective strategy. We've had about 36 referrals through that pathway where, you know, the 1-800 number just hasn't really worked for them. And, you know, anecdotally, people were on hold for over an hour, giving up and just, you know, trying to make do as best they can when there were supports and assistance available. So that was a really good learning that we got from the community, but also I think using the community leaders is essential in getting the messaging out and in simple ways, and also assessing what people need. Now, I remember there was a question to Anne Kavanagh right at the beginning of this forum about what work was done with local governments in the high rise at North Melbourne and Kensington. And I suppose part of what we get from the health service is it is tricky. We do get information about people needing supports in the high rise, but because of privacy and confidentiality, we don't get specific information of those people. So we actually rely on people giving their consent, and then our staff can follow up and find out what the needs are and what the supports they're requiring to either self-isolate or get retested or have, you know, access to a test are, or what their needs for PPE are, and then aim to deliver that to them. So, I mean, we had some, yeah, interesting requests. So it wasn't just about food. It was, we had one person who with disability who had broken their arm and they couldn't brush their teeth and needed an electric toothbrush. So we were able to supply that. So I think, it's not easy because of privacy and confidentiality. And I think that going back to where I started with having those conversations and meetings and forums with the community and community leaders and agencies in the community, and leveraging off those strengths and connections and partnerships enabled us to use them to do a lot of door knocking. So and with interpreters and Auslan interpreters if we needed them, to actually find out what was happening and what was needed on the ground. I suppose that's in a nutshell. I think just a personal reflection, I think COVID-19 has given us all a small taste of what it's like to be unable to access or participate in our community and how that impacts on our well-being and our mental health. And my hope is that we can use our COVID-19 experiences to do more to empower people with disability to live well and be safe in our community once this is passed.
That's great. Thank you so much, Michelle. And it certainly sounds like the City of Yarra does amazing work in working with its very diverse community across a range of areas, and great to hear some of those really concrete examples that you've been able to share with us. And great also that you're, you're sitting there saying, we've got more to learn, we can do it better, we can improve, and to be part of this discussion today, it's really fabulous. I'd like to pass over to Angela Cook now from the CFA. Angela gave us a presentation this morning about the work she's doing with the CFA on supporting people with vulnerabilities to prepare and plan for bushfire, and working with community disability organisations who support people with a disability to support that planning, if you like. So I'm not going to get Angela to go over the details of her project again, but she can certainly touch on them. But Angela, I'm wondering if you've got any further reflections based on what you've heard today and what you've seen today from the various presenters and people with lived experience. Over to you, Angela.
Thanks, Bridget. I think, like I said in my presentation, that when I did some research about what is best practice in Australia and nationally for working with people who have a disability around preparedness planning, the person-centred emergency preparedness approach kept coming up. And then I contacted Associate Professor Michelle Villeneuve from the University of Sydney, and we've been working with her, and I think that's been fundamental in shifting the project in a way. CFA already has, I think, a reasonable focus on community engagement, and we run a number of programs, but I don't think we always focus it down to that level of the individual and in a person-centred, guided conversation way where that individual feels empowered. We often come at it with more of an expert-led approach. Here we are the fire service, we know what you need to do. And here's the list, and we just tick it off. Now, but we actually know we want people to take ownership of the risk and what it means to them, and how their capabilities affect that, then yeah, we definitely need to utilize that more of that person-centered approach. So I think that's quite critical. The only time, and that will work really well in the preparedness phase, when we get to response, that doesn't work so well. You know, that's where we're just telling you what to do. So I was kind of thinking, as an emergency service, we need to be really clear that, hey, in this preparedness stage, we can really have these person-centered based conversations. That's where we need to be. But unfortunately, when we get to response, we're not always going to be able to do that, unfortunately. So that was one thought in my mind about how this needs to happen before. Another thought was around how CFA, we tend to focus things at a community resilience, trying to do a lot of our programs at a community level. And I wonder in how we do that, you know, people, we don't reach everybody, you know, not everyone can come to that community-based kind of sessions. So part of my thinking was, how do we, you know, be more inclusive with that, with our community resilience-based program. So they're the kind of things that I'm thinking about. So I was really interested in the project that Michelle is doing and what Queensland has been doing. So there's some of my reflections. I don't know if anybody else had something to add from the group here about that.
Look, I'd certainly echo what you've said, Angela, and I think that the people that we've heard from today, the people with lived experiences, the various, the videos and the footage, and Tony and her presentation have made it really evident to me that we aren't the experts. Us in emergency management are not the experts. People with a disability are the experts in their own lives, in their own strengths and their own needs. And what we need to do is to make sure that they're at the table as we work to embed disability inclusion in all of our approaches to emergency management, whether it's planning, whether it's response, whether it's relief, or whether it's recovery. Adrian, you've got your hand up. Did you have something you wanted to?
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate some of those thoughts. Like, even I went to a community meeting as this was happening, as it was New Year's Eve in Lakes Entrance. Incident when I walked in, it was like, I don't know how accessible this venue is, and I'm not sure how accessible some of the language, and there certainly wasn't the thought about plain or easy English. And again, it was a highly stressful time for all the community, but that was something that just an observation, and it was like, well, yeah, it sort of was a bit confronting as well. You know, the venue wasn't so accessible. It was a bit of everything, all of the above captured in.
Great. Thanks, Adrian. Thank you, Angela, for that. Really great to hear your reflections based on what you've heard and seen today. I'd like to introduce Christina Ryan. Christina, of course, is the CEO of Disability Leadership. Over to you, Christina.
Oh, thanks very much, Bridget. The Disability Leadership Institute a couple of other things that I've done which might be relevant, but firstly I will acknowledge that I am on Ngunnawal land, beautiful Ngunnawal land, and I will also mention that I openly identify as a disabled person. A couple of other things that I've done in the past have been coordinating the community sector response when I was working at ACT COS, when we've had a couple of major disasters over the years, and I have also run an advocacy organisation, so I know Gippsland Advocacy well through that, and for some period of time I was the chair of the Disability Advocacy Network of Australia. So I'm bringing all of that in into the conversation this afternoon, and I think we've touched on some really important things here. One of them is that if disabled people aren't in the room, it's all about retrofitting, and by the time we get to retrofitting, it's a bit late. What we've learned this year particularly is that things can go wrong, and they can go wrong fast, and they can go wrong in multiple occasions. And so we've started the year, in fact our year started last spring when we were all starting to deal with responding to bushfires and They seem to go forever. There were horrific hailstorms, floods, all sorts of things that have happened before we finally landed with a pandemic. Excellent. So what that's shown us is that if we try doing our consulting and if we try get out there and talk to people with disabilities once those things are underway, well, it's too late. Angela's talked about bringing people into the room early. Michelle's talked about having somebody on the emergency committee. All of these things are the ways that we need to be doing things, and traditionally it hasn't happened. Even what Adrian has mentioned about having accessible relief centres and evacuation centres. And we had multiple examples over the summer of people evacuating to centres, and they might have been wheelchair accessible, but people couldn't get to the mattresses on the floor, or there was nobody, that places were so noisy that people with sensory overload really struggled, you know. So all sorts of things started to come into play. And what it's telling us fundamentally is we can't just forget about disability until, you know, somebody turns up at a relief centre. That's the absolute end point. We did learn during the 2003 bushfires in Canberra a very important lesson. The people who are connected to existing services are the ones who get remembered. The service providers know them, the advocacy organisations know them, and even if they're not current consumers, there's somebody who's going, hang on, what's happening to so-and-so? It's the people who aren't engaged with the service providers or the community services in one way or another, and that's actually a larger proportion of the disability community than we realise. It's only a very small percentage of disabled people who are engaged with services on a regular basis. And so making sure that things are going to be suitable for the broader community is about that planning, the pre-work, making sure that the committees are in place, that it isn't about consulting, it's about having people in decision-making rooms. It's about being part of government, non-government, fire response services. It's a part of being in those spaces. And something that we have also learned is there's a lot of scenario planning and work that the fire authorities go through off-season. They do a lot of work to make sure they're ready for the next summer or most of the year as it's turning into being these days. And that is where we need to be, in those scenario planning situations. We need to make sure that disabled people are included so that we're remembered. And it's not about, some passing person with disability in the street suddenly becoming an expert in all matters disability. It's about having enough of a presence that disability isn't forgotten. People know that they have to go and find the information. I'm not the specialist in the deaf and hard of hearing community. I would need to speak to them to understand exactly what's going on. I do have a broader range of understanding than most people in the disability community because of my work history and what I've done in the past. But we need to recognise that it's the ground-based experience so that those individual solutions can be arrived at without it being an afterthought. It needs to be something that we're almost ready for in advance. So it is about being in the room early, and making sure that we factor disability in right at the very front end of any talk about disaster responses, emergency responses. That way we won't be forgotten, and we'll potentially have a wide array of solutions and flexibility, a much greater capacity for flexibility. And that's what we really need to be looking at.
That's fantastic, Christina. And from my perspective and the work I do at the Victorian Council of Social Service, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's really critical that people with a disability, the organisations that support them, are there from the very outset, that they're included in decision making at local levels, at state levels and at national levels. And, you know, the strengths and needs of people with a disability are really built in from the ground up, so that it's not a question about whether their needs are going to be met. It's just part of the process from day one. And I'd also advocate that that's true of a number of different sectors within the community sector. So, for example, organisations that support culturally and linguistically diverse communities, that support Aboriginal communities and other key groups that may be additionally vulnerable or have additional needs when it comes to emergencies and disasters. Look, this is a fantastic discussion so far, and I'd love for us to talk for the rest of the afternoon, but we will run out of time if we're not careful. I'm really keen to suggestions about something that could be implemented really quickly. If you had a pot of money or somebody had a pot of money that could be thrown at something that would make a tangible difference to people with a disability in your community come the next fire season.
Yeah, there's a number of things. I think initially what needs to occur is each council, each local council has a disability action plan. Some of those disability action plans have greater details across different councils than others. Some are outstanding with their level of information. Others, it appears that they've just really, it's a tick and flick. It's, we do it because we have to, it's a mandate, and they have a disability action plan. We'd be advocating that the disability action plan actually has some responses with regards to emergency situations. Now, that won't need any additional resources or money. It just needs organisations like the local disability advocacy organisation engaged in the disability action plan, but importantly, being peer-led, so having people with disability as part of the reference group that is developing the disability action plan. That's just, it's a front, it's a no-brainer. It's something that Christina has certainly touched on. But, you know, if particularly in these in these times, if disability action plans were reflective of current pandemics and bushfires, that is a start, because it's at a minimum, it's getting councils thinking about the situation. And I loved Christina's thought discussion before that. Disability and accessibility shouldn't be an afterthought, and James alluded to that in his lovely vignettes video, which was really powerful, as they all were. But I felt, yeah, it's really important that we're not an afterthought and we're actually at the table, and that's a key take-home message. You know, we can talk funding, we could talk all different areas, but there are things that don't need funding, it just needs community conversation.
Fantastic, Adrian. Thank you. I really love that idea about community conversation, bringing these things to light, making these things visible, having community members understand that, you know, the people that might live next door to them, you know, have got different challenges and may face different risks and vulnerabilities in the context of an emergency. Fabulous suggestion and very achievable, Adrian, with regard to disability action plans as well. Thank you. Michelle, what about you from a local government perspective? Two or three quick wins.
Totally agree with we call our disability action plan an access and inclusion plan. That, but I think sitting alongside that is at Yarra, we also have a disability advisory committee that provides advice and support to all our business functions on how we can improve the well-being of people with disability in our community, but also their carers. And that could be in universal access, be inclusion, and what best practice is, and aim higher. Just always aim higher. I think for me, a quick win would be, you know, when we look at our emergency management system and apparatus, is everyone in that space actually disability awareness trained or had that awareness training? Because I think until you hear the stories and can appreciate what that experience is like from someone who's lived it, you just don't get it. you just, it's not in the front of your brain. It's not something that you even necessarily, I mean, it's not that for want of not knowing, it just, I think that awareness is really important, and having the opportunity to hear people's stories and understand what that is like, and have empathy and use that knowledge and understanding to improve our practices and our processes and our systems is critical. And that's an easy win.
Great. Thank you so much, Michelle. It certainly is an easy win and a very cost-effective win as well. And I'm really liking these cost-effective approaches, even though I suggested there was some mythical bucket of money ready to be thrown at you. Angela, what about you and the CFA or emergency services more broadly? I guess one of the things we know within the emergency management sector is there's lots and lots of fabulous pilot projects of things that can make a real difference, and they're really exciting, and there's all sorts of learnings and insights, and then they're finished and they're packaged up and they're popped on a shelf and there they gather dust. So how can we make this live on?
That's a really good question, actually. And why do things end up on a shelf gathering dust? Perhaps, I don't know, people might move on. I wonder if there's an issue with continuity and relationships that exist and things happening between people rather at a, I don't know, organisation or systems level. So practical solutions is something I really enjoy figuring out. I think we're very practical at CFA. We're on the ground. We have thousands of members on the ground who deliver community safety, community engagement. Less so at the very minute at the moment with COVID, we're doing a bit more online. But the fact is we are out there, we are in the community. So solutions, there are many. And I think you said 2 to 3. So now I'm thinking, oh gosh, how do I fit this in? For me, I think is planning and preparedness conversations is number one. We need to be having those conversations and thinking about how we can have those conversations with different groups, people with disability, and how we can. I think this Community Safety Month usually comes up in October every year. You know, perhaps that's a way to brand it and have conversations. And we have a bushfire season every year, so surely we can have conversations leading up to that. I mean, that's around bushfire safety, but of course there's house fires and there's floods and a whole range of emergencies. So I think conversations are really, really the heart of how we do that. We've put together some new resources. That's always practical. Resources are very practical. They're available. They will be available on the CFA website in a couple of weeks' time when we launch. Unfortunately, this is just coming a little bit early, just a little bit before we launch them, but they'll be ready pretty soon. And what we've done is we've got some resources. So what we're trying to do is help people help themselves who may have a disability and who either can access and do this, do a plan on their own accord, or who may need some support through their through carers or support workers. So we're looking at resources for both, and I think I talked about that in my presentation. What we need, I suppose, to make that happen is a sector or a organisations, all our disability service organisations on board and enthused about conversations around bushfire. So I get it. I'm sort of marinated in it around bushfire safety. But how do I get others, I think, excited about bushfire when we're currently all marinated in COVID, but soon we're going to have to move into that pre-planning. So there are my thoughts. I'm feeling that if people want to learn more, from the 11th of September, they can jump on CFA's website. It'll be on the front page to link to some of the new resources for workers who work in this space and also for individuals. And then internally for CFA, because I think someone, who was it who just mentioned that just prior to me about some disability awareness kind of training? Well, CFA has purchased the SBS training packages around inclusive, building inclusive
organisations. So we have the training package sitting there on CFA's learning management system around engaging with people with a disability. So that's a win. And but you're right, there's a bit of work to do there. And I think there's some more solutions internally that I can work on as well. So I'll put my hand up a little bit and put myself up for that internally to try and drive a bit more change within CFA. It is happening. It just needs sometimes a little bit of a nudge and a push. Thank you.
That is absolutely fantastic, Angela. We'll hold you to account. You can report back next year. I do want to acknowledge also, of course, that CFA is in large part a volunteer organisation. You've got people volunteering huge amounts of their time to do amazing work in keeping our community safe. And the fact that a volunteer would even, you know, set aside additional time to undergo training and to think about these things is really a credit to the organisation and huge thanks to all of the volunteers. Christina, what about your suggestions for us?
Well, unsurprisingly, I'm going to talk leadership at you. but I've got some clear suggestions and rather than being on the advisory groups, I'd like to know where are the 20% of people on local government councils? We don't have disabled people in politics in Australia. We've got four people across all of the parliaments of this country, four, and none of them are in Victoria. So we've got a situation where it is so unlikely that the ministry or the cabinet will actually have a disabled person inside. It's just not going to happen. Yet. So we need people to think in terms of how do we get disabled people into those decision-making spaces, into the parliaments, onto the local councils, onto the boards that make the decisions, into the executive teams where the money is being allocated so that the resources are there. If people with disabilities are in those spaces, we can't be forgotten. So we need to be in those rooms. The reason why we need to be in those rooms is so we don't get what happened nationally. There was no mention of disability in the pandemic plan when it was first written by the federal government. It took 6 weeks of very serious lobbying from disability representative organisations to actually get a national plan for disability up for the pandemic. So that's what happens when we're not in the room. So it's about being in the room. It's about being elected to those places. It's also about being in those rooms, the boards and the executive teams. So it is about the mayor or the deputy mayor. It's about the, you know, the person running VCOS. It's about all of those sorts of people. It's about, you know, 20% of the Victorian cabinet being disabled people so that we're in the room. There's also a really big need for a lot more talking with those representative organisations beforehand. I mean, we've already covered the fact that we can't wait till an emergency, whatever it is, happens before we start to notice that disabled people exist. So we actually need those representative organisations and the Disability Rights Treaty talks about representative and advocacy organisations need to be consulted. They need to be there. They need to be saying, hang on, you're developing a document with no mention of disability. What's going on? That needs to happen before the emergency hits. Otherwise, it's too late. And that segues into my third really serious suggestion, which is that we need to get better at going into the segregated places. We talk about emergency responses often talk about disabled people having the conversation, let's be ready. But what Adrian and I know, because we've worked in advocacy, is for people who live in segregated environments like small institutions, group houses, those sorts of places, people who are presumed to have someone else looking after them, they don't get involved in those conversations. And come the emergency, they are not asked and they turn up and nobody's thought about them. And they require much more support and they require much more adjustment. So we need to think about how we're engaging with those segregated people, the people we don't see out and about in the community, the people who aren't volunteering with our CFA and other services. So we need leadership so we're not forgotten. We need to be in the room. We need to be talking to the representative organisations in a much more robust and ongoing fashion. and not just about disability, about everything. And we need to be making sure that the people in segregated environments are not forgotten. Of course, the answer to that is get rid of the segregated environments, but that's another panel discussion for another time, not for today. So they're my suggestions.
And what fabulous suggestions they are, Christina. And I know you've got an article coming out soon that that expands on some of those ideas, and we're all looking forward to that. And I'm sure Daru will provide a link to that article for those who are interested. Great.
For everybody's information, it's actually published today. So it's on our website, and I'll provide the link so it's available to everyone this afternoon. Yep.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Christina. I think each of those suggestions are so mostly eminently achievable and certainly something we should all be striving toward and looking toward doing. I'd just like to reflect a little bit on what we've heard, and I think a lot of what we've heard and seen today has been about relationships between people with a disability and their peers, between people with a disability and those organisations that support them, between people with a disability and researchers, advocates, emergency service organisations, local governments and others. We know that emergency management is only effective if it truly works with everyone. And to date, that hasn't included people with a disability. I think today has really presented us with an opportunity to start to work collectively to change that. I think we should build on this relationship between the people here in the room today and the people that have been listening and watching online. I'm really looking forward to the issues paper that's going to come out of today and hopefully to continuing to work with all of you to identify real and practical changes that can ensure people with a disability are included, are represented, play an active role in, and that their needs are met in all aspects of emergency management. I did think we were getting some questions from attendees. And I can, something's come up on my screen, if I can just read it. My eyes aren't very good. Practical preparedness plan is essential. However, I'm sorry, I actually can't read that. I'm going to need somebody to read that out for me. Adrian's going to do this for me. Thank you, Adrian.
A personal preparedness plan is essential. However, doesn't it put unfair burden for safety back on people with disabilities? Shouldn't the emergency response system take greater responsibility for those most at risk?
What a fantastic question. And I know each of you will have a response to that. And I'd really like to offer each of you the opportunity to respond to that. Christina, I'll start with you.
A quick response, yes. It's what we call ableism, to put it back onto the, disabled person to fix the world not being okay. So it is actually up to the systems being structured and the decision-making forums being structured beforehand to be ready, rather than the responsibility of the individual disabled person, particularly if they're in crisis, to be coming up with solutions. That is not the answer. It is not okay to actually be expecting a person who might have just lost their house or, found themselves in some very difficult situation to be the one who is required to come up with solutions. Not okay.
Sorry, thanks, Christina. Adrian, did you have a response to that question?
Yeah, outstanding question. Look, I think that's in essence why today is occurring. Essentially, it's occurring because there's been a lack at different areas of emergency and disability being connected. So essentially, that's why days like today are just so pivotal. I 100% agree with the question, 100%. And unfortunately, that's what we do as disability advocates, is regularly call out situations that should be, for all intents and purposes, achievable, and they're not, and it's an afterthought. So, yeah, outstanding question.
Fantastic. Thank you. Michelle, did you have a response to that question?
I know the NDIS is only one part of the disability sector, But I think, you know, emergency planning, personal emergency planning should be a core element of everyone's package. That being said, there's a lot of people in our community that aren't eligible for the NDIS, and I think government should be working in partnership with emergency services to have the toolkits available and also provide resourcing in, you know, forums or supports or training to have those conversations with people, I suppose, outside of the NDIS and how we can leverage that support in our service sector and the partnerships we have across the service sector, whether it be training, whether it be toolkits, and then to encourage those one-to-one where it's needed supports to help people think about emergency management planning and what will work for them and what their needs are. So to have a much more robust resource, you know, kit bag in our communities to support that really important work. Because it's not just COVID-19. We've got 6 months till the next bushfire season hits. What does our ERCs look like in a COVID-19 space? And where do people with disability intersect with that? So there's a lot of work we need to be doing in this space right now to prepare us for what our emergency responses are in a COVID-19 space, because it's a lot different and it's going to be a lot more challenging to provide relief and supports in COVID-19 than it ever has been before.
Thanks, Michelle. Christina, you just wanted to make a quick point?
Yes, just a small postscript there. Can I make it really clear to people that the NDIS only covers 10% of the disability community? The other 90% are out there using mainstream services and supports, or they don't need regular stuff and they occasionally dip in when things get bad. So the NDIS is not set up to be the disability solution for government. And I've been extremely disturbed during the pandemic and previously during the really bad bushfire season to hear the federal government particularly continually referring to the NDIS for answers, when in fact that's not the purpose of them at all. And as an individual NDIS participant, and I am one, it's almost impossible to speak to them in a hurry and get something happening. That is not what they're there for, and it's not how they operate. So we need to be doing the preparedness. We need to be there before. The NDIS is almost the afterthought, the emergency. And frankly, they're not really good at that either, because they can't be. It's not what they're for. And it's only the 10% of us who are actually NDIS participants who have a call on them anyway.
That's exactly right, Christina, and thanks for that reminder. Angela, did you have an answer to that question? Sorry, thinking about some of the emergency management principles around shared responsibility, I guess, which
that was my exact note. Well, Bridget, you read my mind, but I've got written here. I can even show you. I'd made a big note about, shared responsibility. I feel that in this case, and we talk about this a lot in emergency management, what is shared responsibility? We will do some of it and take on board some of the responsibility, but we need the community organisation to take on board another part of that responsibility, because we just can't do it all. And I think the Bushfires Royal Commission back in 2009-10, that's what, after the 2009 fires, that's what they had stated. And so in this case, I would say the shared responsibility is that a person with a disability is the expert in their lives, in their capabilities, understanding their needs. And then in the case of CFA, well, we're the expert in fire safety, and we need to work together to work out what that means for that individual in their own circumstances. But we can't go in and assume, I suppose, everybody's in the same circumstances. Obviously, like Christina pointed out, with different types of functional capabilities, different situations, and whether people have support or not in their home.
Thank you, Angela. Really, really good points. And I think that goes back to a lot of what I was talking about earlier around relationships and the importance of networks and partnerships and organisations and individuals talking to one another and getting on the same page and working together, working collectively to really embrace that notion of shared responsibility and disability inclusive emergency planning, preparedness, response, relief and recovery. I believe we are out of time. I have so enjoyed this conversation. It has been absolutely fantastic. I think this could become a yearly forum. Mel, I'm looking at you because, of course, you don't have enough to do on a day-to-day basis to think about pulling together something like this online. If I could just thank all of the panellists for your amazing insight, for sharing your experiences with us. Thank you so much. Over to you, Mel.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. What a fantastic discussion. So just in summary, we have heard that while we in Australia have some good frameworks and policies that guide our emergency responses, and compared to what's happening globally, we aren't doing too badly. However, there's so much more we need to do to ensure that people with disabilities have the same protections in an emergency as their neighbours, colleagues and other Australians. While we have some great ideas and great systems in place to be able to commence the emergency planning process for people with disabilities, there is no funding for disability advocacy or any other services to take the time to actively work on making and implementing those emergency plans until it's way too late. It's been very clearly demonstrated today that people with disabilities are absolutely the experts of their own needs and need the support and tools around them to assist in making sure that they have the time, space, and appropriate support to put plans in place to protect themselves and their families in the event of an emergency. It's time to take this out of pilot phase. The time for trialing and short-term project testing things is well past us. The disasters are here. It's real and it's not waiting for anyone. It's time to take action, make those plans real, and put support around people with disabilities without delay today. A whole lot of things have come out of today, and Daru absolutely commits to not leaving the discussion here. We want to ensure that this rich information is captured and used as a tool for advocacy to ensure that the next pandemic we face, the next bushfire, the next flood, and that any emergency plan that kicks in is inclusive of all people. My biggest appreciation and thank you goes to those people with disabilities who contributed their stories. Not just stories for today, but those who contributed and relived their trauma for studies, research surveys, the recent Royal Commission hearings, and everything else that has been done in relation to the disasters of 2020. It's all hard, it's all traumatic, but without your stories, we don't know anything to be able to make a change. So thank you. Thank you to all the presenters and facilitators and panelists for your contribution today. You are all absolute change makers, and I look forward to assisting you to progress your work going forward from here. Thank you to the interpreters and captioners. Thank you to Show Division for the technology and making this work today. Thank you to my colleagues at Daru for working behind the scenes at all hours to make this work for you all today. You're absolute legends. Thank you for watching. Have a wonderful afternoon. Stay safe, wash those hands, wear those masks, and stay home. Bye-bye.